three sections of that sermon. One of those sermons is this sermon number 147, which starts like this: فَبَعَثَ اللَّهُ مُحَمَّدًا بِالْحَقِّ لِيُخْرِجَ عِبَادَهُ مِنْ عِبَادَةِ الْأَوْثَانِ إِلَى عِبَادَتِهِ وَمِنْ طَاعَةِ الشَّيْطَانِ إِلَى طَاعَتِهِ. You see, this is how Sayyid Radhi starts, and rather, you know, quotes the sermon from Imam Ali alayhi salam. But it's obvious that there were some words before that, because the word starts suddenly. It says that, and so Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sent Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam with truth to bring the people out of the obedience and, you know, worship of the idols. So this is like, you know, you can't start a sermon like that. You need to start, normally you say Amma Ba'ad, or you start like that and with another introductory sermon, or you start with Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And therefore, we can say that this sermon came from, maybe was quoted from in between, or kind of from, you know, rather the beginning parts, but not the complete beginning part of the sermon.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, coming into the topic, diving into the topic straight away, what we want to discuss now is just an introduction to this sermon. In the introduction, we want to mention that in this sermon, Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about certain important things. One thing is that he wants to talk about the wonders that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam presented to the people. He wants to talk about what the aim of the message of the Prophet was. Where does the Prophet want to take us with this message? What destination does he want to make us reach? And what was the means through which he invited us to reach that destination? And what is the benefit of the Quran? And how wonderful is this means of the Quran? Then he starts another discussion, which is the important issue of the life of the Muslim Ummah and the Muslims themselves. That if the life of the Muslim Ummah is not in conformity with the lifestyle that Allah expects from the people, from the Muslims, then this Muslim Ummah is facing the greatest of losses. And then he goes on to say that all these blessings, material and spiritual blessings, prophets and messengers with all the difficulties that they bore, they were only for one purpose, and that is to ripen this unripe fruit of humanity, of the Muslim Ummah, and to perfect it and nourish it to become what it has to be. And therefore, if we as Muslims, as the Muslim Ummah, sees that they perceive FCs and that they experience the same ignorances and wretchedness that the previous nations faced, even now after the coming of all of these messengers and prophets who came and presented nice things to us, who gifted us with the message of God and truth, and if still after all those years we still experience those wretchednesses and ignorances and inabilities and hopelessnesses, then it is about time for us to get hold on to the means that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam has brought, and that is the means of the Holy Quran. So basically, this is a kind of a statement that wants to create that awakening amongst the Muslims. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
In the limelight. Canada installed an Indigenous woman as its Governor General on Monday, 26th of July, the first such person to hold the post in an elaborate ceremony that spotlighted the country's efforts to reconcile with its colonial past. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau named Mary Simon, a former journalist, ambassador, and Inuit community advocate, to serve as a representative in Canada of its head of state, Queen Elizabeth, earlier this month. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Steve Shearer. It has been taken from the Reuters news agency. The piece is titled, Canada Installs First Indigenous Governor-General, Highlights Reconciliation. Canada installed an Indigenous woman as its Governor-General on Monday, 26th of July, the first such person to hold the post in an elaborate ceremony that spotlighted the country's efforts to reconcile with its colonial past. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau named Mary Simon, a former journalist, ambassador, and Inuit community advocate, to serve as a representative in Canada of its head of state, Queen Elizabeth, earlier this month. Mary Simon is the first Indigenous person to take on the role, created more than 400 years ago to represent the colonial power on North American soil. The change comes as Canada grapples with the legacy of its treatment of its Indigenous population. We need people like Ms. Simon because we need people to build bridges and bring us together, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said at the ceremony. Since May, hundreds of unmarked graves of children have been discovered at former residential schools run for Indigenous children forcibly separated from their families in what a Truth and Reconciliation Commission has called cultural genocide. I have heard from Canadians who describe a renewed sense of possibility for our country and hope that I can bring people together, Simon, a 73-year-old, said, after being installed as Governor-General. The ceremony, broadcast by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, also in Simon's native Inuktitut language, was scaled back and face masks were worn due to COVID-19. A drummer accompanied her entry into the Senate, where she took an oath. The Governor-General performs functions such as swearing in governments and formally signing legislation, but is also the Commander-in-Chief of the Canadian military and can summon or dissolve the Parliament. Over a span of nearly 2 months, more than 1,300 unmarked graves have been discovered at the sites of four former residential schools across Canada, a fraction of the more than 130 residential schools once funded by the federal government. At least 150,000 Indigenous children were sent to residential schools, a system of forced assimilation that sought to strip the youth of their identity. Because the schools were notoriously brutal, the existence of unmarked graves at the site of the schools has long been known within Indigenous communities in Canada. As the number of sites discovered grows, so too have questions over how to proceed amid concerns over protocol, logistics, and proper ceremony. Children from different communities often attend the same school. Some First Nations might want to exhume all the graves at a particular residential school, while others might only want to mark and commemorate the site. In 2015, Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission estimated that as many as 4,100 children had died attending the schools, but many now believe that figure must be revised upwards in light of recent discoveries. Disease was rampant in many of the schools, and children forced to attend died at a far higher rate than the general population. But the age of the remains presents challenges in identifying the cause of death. During testimony to Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, many survivors of the residential schools said that children were sometimes beaten to death at the schools.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
این وجود مقدس رو ما اینجوری میشناسیمش ماها که شیعه هستیم
We as the Shia Muslims believe that the promised last savior of the world was born and has been alive during all these years. We believe in his holy character in this way. This is why we believe in the Ahlul Bayt, visit their tombs and ask them to ask Allah to answer our prayers. In other words, all the Shia Muslims believe that the system and the house of Ahlul Bayt is the same as the divine one and nothing else.
که امام صادق فرمود ولایتنا ولایت الله ولایت ما همون ولایت خداست
As Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam also stated, our wilaya is the wilaya of Allah, or our guardianship is the guardianship of Allah. This sentence of Imam As-Sadiq means that if a person is under the custody of the Ahlul Bayt, he or she is under the custody of Allah. In fact, Ahlul Bayt practice the orders of Allah on earth. Thus, if we as the Shias ask the Ahlul Bayt to help us, is because we believe they are truthful vicegerent of Allah on earth. This is completely different from what the Wahhabis believe in the Shias. They say that the Shias believe in their Imams as God. This is false. The Shias believe that the Ahlul Bayt were the true servants of Allah on earth, and their souls are very much closer to Allah. So in their prayers and supplications, they ask them to ask Allah to answer their prayers. In other words, Imams of the Ahlul Bayt are the link and bridge between the people and Allah, because the Ahlul Bayt were the true vicegerent of Allah on earth. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanillah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
According to interviews with 10 leading COVID-19 experts, vaccine protection remains very strong against severe infections and hospitalizations caused by any version of the coronavirus, and those most at risk are still the unvaccinated. We are prepared for an article written jointly by Julie Steenhuisen, Alistair Smout, and Ari Rabinovich. The piece is titled How the Delta Variant Upends Assumptions About the Coronavirus. The article has been published by the Reuters news agency. According to virologists and epidemiologists, the Delta variant is the fastest, fittest, and most formidable version of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 the world has encountered, and it is upending assumptions about the disease, even as nations loosen restrictions and open their economies. According to interviews with 10 leading COVID-19 experts, vaccine protection remains very strong against severe infections and hospitalizations caused by any version of the coronavirus, and those most at risk are still the unvaccinated. The major worry about the Delta variant, first identified in India, is not that it makes people sicker, but that it spreads far more easily from person to person, increasing infections and hospitalizations among the unvaccinated. These experts said evidence is also mounting that it is capable of infecting fully vaccinated people at a greater rate than previous versions, and concerns have been raised that they may even spread the virus. Microbiologist Sharon Peacock, who runs Britain's effort to sequence the genomes of coronavirus variants, said, "The biggest risk to the world at the moment is simply Delta, calling it the fittest and fastest variant yet." Viruses constantly evolve through mutation, with new variants arising. Sometimes these are more dangerous than the original virus. Until there is more data on Delta variant transmission, disease experts say that wearing face masks, social distancing, and other measures set aside in countries with broad vaccination campaigns may again be needed. Public Health England said on Friday, 23rd of July, that out of a total of 3,692 people hospitalized in Britain with a Delta variant of the coronavirus, 58.3% were unvaccinated and 22.8% were fully vaccinated. In Singapore, while Delta is the most common variant, government officials reported on Friday, 23rd of July, that three-quarters of its coronavirus cases occurred among vaccinated individuals, though none were severely ill. French health officials have said 60% of current hospitalized COVID cases are in vaccinated people. Most of them are aged 60 or older and often have underlying health problems. In the United States, which has experienced more COVID-19 cases and deaths than any other country, the Delta variant represents about 83% of new infections. So far, unvaccinated people represent nearly 97% of severe cases. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine appeared only 41% effective at halting symptomatic infections in the United States over the past month as the Delta variant spread. American experts said this information requires more analysis before conclusions can be drawn. Researchers said protection for the individual is very strong. Protection from infecting others is significantly lower. A study in China found that people infected with the Delta variant of the coronavirus carry 1,000 times more virus in their noses compared with the ancestral Wuhan strain, first identified in that Chinese city in 2019. Microbiologist Sharon Peacock said, "You may actually excrete more virus, then that's why it's more transmissible. That's still being investigated." Virologist Shane Crotty of the La Jolla Institute for Immunology in San Diego, California, noted that Delta is 50% more infectious than the Alpha variant first detected in the United Kingdom. Shane Crotty added, "It's outcompeting all other viruses because it just spreads so much more efficiently." Genomics expert Eric Topol, director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute in La Jolla, California, noted that Delta infections have a shorter incubation period and a far higher amount of viral particles. Eric Topol said, "That's why the vaccines are going to be challenged. The people who are vaccinated have got to be specially careful. This is a tough one." In the United States, the Delta variant has arrived as many Americans, vaccinated and not, have stopped wearing face masks indoors. Eric Topol said, "It's a double whammy," adding, "The last thing you want is to loosen restrictions when you're confronting the most formidable version of the virus yet." The development of highly effective vaccines may have led many people to believe that once vaccinated, COVID-19 posed little threat to them. Carlos De Rio, a professor of medicine and infectious disease epidemiology at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, said, "When the vaccines were first developed, nobody was thinking that they were going to prevent infection." De Rio added, "The aim was always to prevent severe disease and death. However, the vaccines were so effective that there were signs the vaccines also prevented transmission against prior coronavirus variants." De Rio added, "We got spoiled." Dr. Monica Gandhi, an infectious disease doctor at the University of California at San Francisco, said, "People are so disappointed right now that they're not 100% protected from mild breakthroughs, getting infected despite having been vaccinated." But Dr. Monica Gandhi added, "The fact that nearly all Americans hospitalized with COVID-19 right now are unvaccinated is pretty astounding effectiveness.
There are a couple of scholars who came with the new ideas, who came with the better principles. And when they came up with those principles and better ideas, how to extract something out of the statement that we have, or what are the principles? Mirza Naini is one of those scholars.
It must be indicated that amongst the publications and works of the late Ayatollah Mirza Manat Hussein Gharavi Naini, his book Tanbih al-Ummah wa Tanzih al-Millah is very significant.
Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of it?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the All Beneficent, the All Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. I have two guest speakers for my today's discussion in the program. The teacher, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhrohani, and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhrohani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, an Islamic scholar from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So in the series of the characters and the dignitaries, we have been concerned, especially the Muslim scholars. Today we want to talk about an outstanding figure of contemporary Iran, Muhammad Hussein Gharavi Naini, mainly known as Ayatollah Gharavi Naini, who was a Shia jurist and expert in principles of jurisprudence, and also a supporter of the constitutional revolution in Iran, with which we'll be concerned and we'll discuss it more. Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, let's start with you, brother. Muhammad Hussein Naini was among the best explicators of Sheikh al-Ansari's principle of thought and, we can say, method of research regarding Usul al-Fiqh and Fiqh. What more information do we have about the scholarly background and the biography of Muhammad Hussein Gharavi Naini, mainly known as Ayatollah Gharavi Naini?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Gharavi Naini, or Mirza Naini.
That's right.
Because we have these two famous names about
okay.
him. He was born on 15th of Zilqadda in 1276 Hijri. And he belongs to a scholarly family because his father and his grandfather, both of them, they were Sheikh al-Islam of Isfahan at their time. His father, obviously, Sheikh Abdul Rahim, and his grandfather, Muhammad Said, Sheikh Muhammad Said. They both were from the Sheikh al-Islam of Isfahan, and they were very close to the governments of the time. Now, this is very important that whenever we see the life of some scholars whose fathers or, you know, grandparents were the scholars themselves, obviously it also conveys us another message, that the way he was brought up in his house,
that's right,
that was a house where there was an environment of, you know, scholarly discussions. The family, all the family were educated, the whole family, from, you know, the ladies and the gents. Because generally we talk about the males in the family. We
That's
do
right.
not talk about the females. Whereas, you know, that the child is with the mother all the time.
That's all right.
Generally the parents or the fathers
That's
are
all right.
like they're busy outside mm-hmm. studying, researching, okay. I don't know, answering people. So since they were Sheikh al-Islam, from Sheikh Naini himself, like Muhammad Hussein, when we talk about him himself,
right.
Mirza Naini, if he was brought up in a such a way, it wasn't only about his father.
Mm-hmm.
It was about his family as well, his
That's
mother
right.
and the environment which was in the family.
Yeah, the mother had really direct role. Although some of the ulama's mothers' names are documented in the history,
yes.
it is claimed that most of the mothers of the family were the memorizers of the whole Quran. They were masters in recitations of the Holy Qurans and Du'as, and they had a school-like gatherings in the neighborhood in order to, as we call it, the maktab in Farsi, okay? In order to teach the children, the girls and the little girls were taught by the women of the neighborhood, especially the scholarly ones, and the men were by the sheikhs or we can say the ulama on that time. This was a habit on that time. Unfortunately, we missed this good habit nowadays in neighborhoods in Iran.
So basically, we need to have attention to these things as
Yes, it is.
It's something which is ignored, because whenever we come and discuss about an alim, we generally talk about him and his fathers only.
That's all right.
The lineage that he has.
Yeah, the lineage.
We don't talk about the environment that they have in their family. Because, you know, if we're talking about a scholar who became famous, there is a big role of his mother. For example, for Allama Hilli, it is said, like, his mother used to cook food for him.
That's right.
He never had eaten anything from outside.
Yes.
Even if they used to go somewhere, he used to take the food and, you know, prepare things.
Being on wuzu when breastfeeding the child,
when breastfeeding, being in the state of the wudu, this was the habit.
Yes.
So all these things are there.
Important, that's right.
I remember, you know, one of the speeches of Supreme Leader, he said, like, in old age, we had the mothers who had the best character, who raised kids, who became, like, alim or scholar or mystics.
That's right.
And all the things they were doing was from the Mafatihul Jannah, for example.
Yes.
You know,
okay.
And there were the books, specific books of supplications.
Yes. Yes.
They used to read those books,
yes.
And they used to live according to those books. But today...
But it was not only reading, brother. It was practicing.
Yeah, that's the main thing. Important. Because, you know, when they're in-house, there's an environment.
That's right.
Obviously, when they read, they're practicing those things. And in today's world also, our, you know, sisters and mothers should also go back to the same original things, you know, these supplication books. They have a lot of things in there which helps them in training the kids.
That's
to
right.
Brought up in a good way. So basically, he was brought up in a scholarly family, we can say, and there was a big role of his mother and the father, both of them, and the family itself.
That's right.
And he started his early education in Isfahan, in his house, sorry. And later, when he was 17 years old, he went to Isfahan to enter the Hawza.
Right.
And the good thing about him, which has been said in the history, is that he used to study in the Hawza as well as at the house.
That's all right.
So he also benefited from his father things that were in the house. I remember, like, when I was about to come to the Hawza, my father said, don't buy any book.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have all the books in house.
That's all right.
So if you want to, do not buy, use library whenever you come back to, you know, like the country. You can use these books.
Very good.
So there is... an environment.
That's
all
right.
And he basically really benefited from
that's
that,
right.
We can say, like, advantages.
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 Yes, so of the scholarly family, of, we can say, religious family in which he was born. Dr. Fakhrani, at the age of 17, and after passing the primary studies, he went to Isfahan. He went under the tutelage of Sheikh Muhammad Baqir Isfahani or Jahangir Khan Qashqai. You know, he was a great scholar on that time. Theology, philosophy, jurisprudence, especially philosophy was taught on that time in Isfahan, Hawza too, and Arabic and Persian grammar and mathematics. And then he enters the Hawza of Samarra in Iraq. What information do we have about his studies in Iraq, brother?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin as-Sin. Thank you very much for providing me with this opportunity.
You're welcome, brother.
Regarding the late Ayatollah Gharavi Naini, it must be indicated that at that time, a couple of prominent Shia houses were available. I mean, on the eastern side, Lucknow in India was very famous. And then in Persia, Isfahan was very famous because Isfahan at that time was inheriting the legacy of the Safavid dynasty that was in Isfahan. As you know, Isfahan was the capital and the seat of the Safavid administration and government.
Definitely.
And many books were authored in Isfahan. For example, the great magnum opus Bihar al-Anwar was compiled in Isfahan. If we assume that no other book was compiled in Isfahan save Bihar al-Anwar, this is enough for the whole history of Isfahan and the Hawza of Isfahan.
Okay.
However, the shrine cities in Iraq, Karbala, Najaf, Qazamin, and Samarra, were very famous because of being, historic cities and pilgrimage cities of, I mean, the Shi'i denomination. However, we find that at that time, because of strengthening, for the purpose of strengthening the Shi'i community in Samarra, the late Mirza Shirazi, the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Shirazi, he transferred, I mean, his academic seat or community from Najaf to Samarra in order to strengthen the Shi'i community in Samarra. So for some time, we find that, I mean, Samarra flourished, I mean, over there.
Even so, beside Najaf and Karbala, Samarra flourished, Samarra's Hausa.
Even today, the, I mean, small Shi'i community in Samarra are, in fact, the, I mean, the traces of that movement of the, I mean, the late Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Shirazi. But it wasn't only for the sake of academic purposes, or, I mean, for the sake of simply strengthening the Shi'i community in Samarra. Rather, since Samarra was a Sunni populated community in, I mean, in the northern part of the, I mean, Arabic side of Iraq,
That's
or
right.
the Arabic territory of Iraq, and because of this, the Othmanids, I mean, from ancient Turkey, the Othmanids, I mean, had, I mean, special influence over there. And since we know that, I mean, the, I mean, Iraq has been the, I mean, the arena of, I mean, two opposing forces, the Shi'i forces from Iran and the Sunni forces from Othmanis, coupled with the, at that time, emergent Wahhabi thought, I mean, from Arabia. It was the sagacity of the late Ayatollah, Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Shirazi to take his academic seat from Najaf to Samarra. First of all, apparently, this was because Samarra was a pilgrimage city over there. But back behind it, there was another philosophy. I mean, he meant to strengthen, I mean, to reinforce the Shi'i community in an apparently non-Shi'i environment.
And this was the reason that Ayatollah
Karabi Naini moved from Isfahan to
Samarra.
And not directly from, I mean, to Najaf. Well, I mean, on pilgrimage occasions, Ayatollah Karabi Naini traveled to other pilgrimage cities, but he preferred to remain in Samarra together with the late Sayyid Hassan Shirazi.
Okay, and was he contemporary to Akhund al-Khurasani at that time? He was contemporary with Akhund Khorasani.
And to my knowledge, for some time, he studied before Akhund Khorasani, and he explicated some of the views of Akhund Khorasani. But the point is that Akhund Khorasani was a prodigy in Usul al-Fiqh, like, I mean, Ayatollah Gharavi Naini. However, Ayatollah Gharavi Naini almost never attended the open classes of Ayatollah Akhund Khorasani. However, he attended the special expert community or assembly or expert, I mean, academy directed by Ayatollah Akhund Khorasani. And it shows that Ayatollah Gharavi Naini was already an authority in Usul al-Fiqh, because, I mean, he almost never attended the open classes of Usul al-Fiqh led and taught by Akhund Khorasani. Rather, he was invited to a special gatherings on very delicate issues in Usul al-Fiqh led by Ayatollah Akhund Khorasani.
For issuing fatwa council or iftar,
isn't it? Yes, there was a board of, fatwa issuing or issuing fatwas. I mean, and even at the moment, even nowadays in Qom, Mashhad, Najaf, Karbala, great scholars or great mujtahids or maraj taqlid, they have their own special board of, discussing very delicate issues, And it was to the benefit of not Ayatollah Gharavi Naini, but the existing maraj taqlid in Najaf and Karbala, that's who benefited from the expertise and sagacity of the late Ayatollah Gharavi Naini.
That's all right.
On the board of, issuing fatwas.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Dr. Mohammad Reza Fakhrohani. Also, Said Mohsen Naqvi, for your introductory remarks regarding the late Ayatollah Mohammad Hossein Gharavi Naini. We will get into more details of the scholarly life of this outstanding Ayatollah, also the role that he had in the socio-political reforms of his time. On that time, he was not a simple Ayatollah and Alam scholar, I mean, issuing fatwa and being in the Iftar Council of Akhund Khorasani helped him very much in order to apply some of these fatwas in the daily lives of the people, especially in the socio-political scene of his era and his time, which made him very much different from the other scholars of his time. The late Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Gharavi Naini. Thank you, Mashaykh Tufakh.
Welcome.
And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. And dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode. In order to know more about our other episodes of the program, The Teacher, refer to our website and visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
In the limelight.
The entry of the destroyer Sahand and the floating naval base name Makron into the Baltic Sea and the Gulf of Finland and their docking at St. Petersburg for participation in the parade on the anniversary of Russia's Naval Day is indeed a feather in the cap of the Iranian Navy. The Iranian Navy is equipped with the state-of-the-art vessels of all kinds and capable of deterring the devilish designs of its enemies. Yet, it is without the least doubt an ambassador of peace, as could be evident by participation of its ships in the St. Petersburg Naval Parade. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading, Iranian Navy Comes of Age. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. It is indeed a great milestone for the Iranian Navy and proof of the independent policies of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The entry of the destroyer Sahand and the floating naval base named Makron into the Baltic Sea and the Gulf of Finland and their docking at St. Petersburg for participation in the parade on the anniversary of Russia's Naval Day is indeed a feather in the cap of the Iranian Navy. It is not just proof of the friendship between Tehran and Moscow and their joint efforts to safeguard peace, but a slap on the face of the meddling Americans that they cannot do a damn thing. After keeping the regimes of the US and West Europe in suspense following the Iranian Navy's entry into the Atlantic Ocean for the first time ever a couple of months ago, these two vessels have demonstrated the seawolfiness of the Islamic Republic's naval forces, which have finally come of age. Gone are the days of the pre-revolution Iran, when the unrepresentative regime used to buy obsolete naval vessels from the West at exorbitant prices and display these junks as a means of defense in the Persian Gulf. Today, the Islamic Republic of Iran builds its own vessels, ranging from destroyers and frigates to speedboats, submarines, and floating naval bases that are more than a match for any intruding enemy warships, which wisely avoid any confrontation in the narrow Straits of Hormuz. The Iranian Navy is equipped with state-of-the-art vessels of all kinds and capable of deterring the devilish designs of its enemies. Yet, it is without the least doubt an ambassador of peace, as could be evident by participation of its ships in the St. Petersburg Naval Parade. And this speaks of the international might of the Iranian Navy. and. In the words of Iran's Navy Chief Rear Admiral Hossein Khanzadi, the sailing of Iranian ships to the Gulf of Finland and the easternmost arm of the Baltic Sea is a historic event. He added, this success means the opening of the gates of the North Sea and Finland to the fleet of the Islamic Republic of Iran Army. It is to be noted that the Gulf of Finland extends between Finland to the north and Estonia to the south, to St. Petersburg in Russia to the east, where the Neva River drains into it. Now, after navigating in the waters of the Atlantic Sea, the next step for the Iranian Navy is expected to be the coast of the Americas, followed by passage through the Panama Canal to the Pacific Ocean. Once the Iranian Navy achieves this distinction, it will have the honor of being the first Muslim country to circumnavigate the world on its way back to the Persian Gulf.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام لا مصيبة كعدم العقل.
إمام الباقر عليه السلام stated, there is no affliction worse than a lack of intellect.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find, dear friends, in the beautiful conversations of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the divinely appointed Imam, we find that he talks about certain things with his companions, which when we delve a little deeper, we find that they are beautiful pearls of wisdom and knowledge. And these pearls of wisdom and knowledge truly can help us and our societies and our world to become a better place. In one of these instances, when Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is having a conversation with his companions, we find that in response to a question from his companion, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, "Be careful of your friends, except the trusty one who fears Allah." It's very interesting, dear friends, but in this day and age of social media and even non-social media, for example, school and workplace and these kind of social areas, we make a lot of friends, we make a lot of acquaintances, we get to know a lot of people. But dear friends, keep in mind that not every single person is trustworthy. Yes, your parents are trustworthy. Yes, I mean, that's pretty much it. Your parents are the most trustworthy person that you can rely on. Of course, this does not mean that you should have a negative view about your friends, but always be careful. Here, Imam al-Baqir says, yes, the one who is trustworthy and the one who fears Allah, this is truly a good friend. And of course, this makes sense if you have an acquaintance or you have a friend who does not fear Allah, then they are bound to take you towards a path which could very well lead away from Allah. But the friend who is trustworthy and who fears Allah will always keep you on a path which goes towards Allah. For not only will they fear disobeying Allah, but they will help you to fear disobeying Allah as well. Beautiful words of wisdom. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
One or two, you know, incidents from his life about his akhlaq, just to learn the seerah of the Imam, is the issue of, you know, sabr, patience in dealing with the people who are rude to you. And we see this example in the life of the Prophet, in the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen, in the example of Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, Imam Zain al-Abidin. But since we are remembering the fifth Imam, let us look at his example, where somebody, and it seems, you know, people had been brainwashed against the Ahlul Bayt. And this individual was from Ahlul Kitab, either a Christian or a Jew, we don't know. And he was an Arab. We're talking about Ahl Kitab from the Arab community. Knowing the Imam and his name and his laqab, his name was Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam, but Baqir was the laqab, the title. So he knew that. So he comes and, you know, when he met him, instead of addressing him the way he is addressed normally, he says to him, "Anta Baqir." Baqir means a cow. And Baqir is very different. According to historians, Imam was lenient. He smiled at him and he says, "Maybe you have forgotten my laqab." لا أنا باقر. I am not بقر, I am باقر. So this person continued insulting the Imam. And he says to him, أنت ابن الطباخ. Remember, we're talking about the Eastern society, especially among the Arabs. To insult someone's mother is the crossing of the limit. But see how Imam deals with this situation. Then he says, you are the son of a woman who works in the kitchen, tabakha, who is a cook. Again, Imam does not, you know, he realized now this person is really after me because he said Baqar and I said I'm Baqar. Now he is talking about me as Ibn Tabakha. Imam still looked at him and said, well, you know, at home, yes, she works in the kitchen. That's what she does as a wife and a mother. So what's wrong with that? Imam doesn't respond or argue with him on that issue.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
In the limelight.
Some do not understand how exactly the Israeli regime's policy makes normal life impossible for Palestinians in Gaza, even when it's not bombing it. The siege amounts to a war crime. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Electronic Intifada. This article is titled How Zionist Regime Slowly Suffocates Gaza. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Gaza is still reeling from the Zionist regime's 11-day bombing campaign in May. The Israeli regime assault started just before the Eid al-Fitr, marking the end of Ramadan, and ended with the killing of at least 245 Palestinians in Gaza, including 66 children. The bombs may have stopped dropping, but the devastation continues. Palestinians in the coastal enclave have been left to rebuild and recover from widespread destruction while living under a 14-year Israeli regime blockade that appears to hamper this process on certain political negotiations and outcomes. Since the assault, only food, medical supplies, fuel, animal fodder, and raw materials for critical industries have been allowed into the territory, the Times of Israel reported. Israeli regime occupation authorities have used their absolute control over maritime, airspace, and land entry and exit points to achieve political goals and objectives, according to the Gaza-based rights group Al-Mizan. Israeli regime politicians have suggested that they intend to reduce the amount of cash they allow into the street. On July 14th, Israeli regime authorities allowed the entry of commercial goods, including clothes, for the first time since its assault, according to Safa News Agency. This came after COGAT, the bureaucratic arm of the Israeli regime's military occupation, the war